Well, I'm going to ask all of the panelists to introduce themselves briefly, and then we'll let them all. So each of the panelists, the way this is going to work is the panelists are going to give a 5 to 7 minute long presentation, and then there's going to be open discussion, so time for questions. That said, if, you know, right after the end of somebody talking, if you have a quick question, that's fine. I don't want people, just to echo what Kim is saying, the object here, so it turns out there's internet all over the place and you can check your email anywhere, but you're here. And you're here with a bunch of really smart people who are interested in engaging with you. So engage with them. All right. So go ahead, Tip, if you want to just start quickly.
Hi, I'm Tip Mosley. I'm from Google.
Hi, I'm Brandon Lucia. I'm from the University of Washington. I just finished my PhD there, and now I'm going to go and be working at Microsoft Research later this fall in automatic failure avoidance systems.
Hi, I'm Niall Dalton from Cal Zeta. I build big, interesting clusters using ARM processors. I've also been a high-frequency trader and CTO of a database company, Columnar Databases. Unfortunately, every time I touch computers, they tend to be broken computers. So I'm looking forward to talking about tools for those.
Hi, Paul Peterson. I'm working at Intel in the software development tools group, and I'll be talking more about that later in my intro.
Okay, great.
Brandon's going to take it away.
Hi, everyone. Can everyone hear me right now? Is this mic working? Yeah? Good. Cool. Okay, so I'm going to talk about today tools in the real world, and being the university person on the panel, I guess I was the ironic choice for the real world portion of the program. But what I'm going to talk about today is just some themes in the tools research that I've done during the time that I've been doing that, and some ideas that I think are interesting kind of going forward, things that I think are going to be increasingly relevant. So the thing I want to start by talking about is a way of reasoning about doing tools research that has been helpful and kind of instructive to me, and I wanted to share it with everyone here and get people's opinion if they have one. And the idea is really simple. It's that tools boil down, software development tools boil down to three things. There's the data that they consume, there's the abstraction that we use to look at that data, and there's some analysis that we throw at that abstracted data and then get some useful conclusions out of it. And I'm going to talk about what these three points mean, but this is kind of a high-level description of this this breakdown of tools research. So data is what development tools eat. So thinking about data, we can think about things like program traces if we have some dynamic analysis tool, or source code if we have a static analysis tool, or you could even think of things like programmer input, environment, things like that. So data is sort of the raw material that we start with when we use tools. And in order to make that stuff useful, we need some way of looking at it. So we start with this big pile of raw, unorganized data, and then we need to apply some organization. So I think of this as abstraction. I'm using that term loosely. You could say representation or organization or something else too. But the distinction here is that instead of looking at a program trace, a raw program trace, you might instead look at event traces and things like that. And there's lots of tools that do this step almost without realizing it. But I think in doing tools research, it's been helpful for me to think about how you go from the raw material that is the data to the abstracted version. And the reason we use those abstractions is to facilitate analyses which are what produces conclusions and help us to do things when we're developing software. So if we're looking at a debugging tool, it's what tells us, hey, this is why your bug is happening. And if it's a performance analysis tool, it's something that says, hey, go and change this code because that's why you're having these performance problems and things like that. So to just keep the running example of the program trace, you have program traces, you abstract them to an event trace, and then you could look at something like a type state analysis. That'd be something that you might use an event trace for to reason about why your whatever socket implementation isn't following its type state state machine correctly. And there's lots of other kinds of analysis. Anomaly detection would qualify. You could do structural graph analyses and things like that. So this breakdown of tools research, like I said, has been useful, and it's not an especially sophisticated breakdown, but I think it's something that's fun to think about. And I actually want to do a little shameless plug for some of my own work that follows this methodology. So just to give you a concrete example of the kind of data abstraction and analysis breakdown, there was some work that I did that showed up at PLDI in 2011. This was a software development tool that helped programmers understand why their programs were failing because of some concurrency bugs. So the data part here was we developed a system that used binary instrumentation or hardware support to collect a trace of shared memory accesses. So the data there was this trace of shared memory accesses. We abstracted that using a graph abstraction that I'm not going to explain, but it was called a context-aware communication graph. And it basically encoded how threads interact during an execution. And then looking at a big set of those graphs collected using the data that we collect from each run of the program, we're able to do some analysis and actually reconstruct the root cause of a failure. So this is sort of the model that I fit over this this tool flow, the data abstraction analysis model. Okay, so now that was just sort of half of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to spend four more slides and just a couple more minutes talking about some trends in tools research. And I guess these are trends that I see in both the real world and the, you know, papers world of academic tools research that I think are really interesting and I think are going to be increasingly important. So the first is something that I've mentioned twice now, one in anomaly detection and another in describing Recon, that project I just described, and that is statistical modeling of software behavior and statistical analysis of those models. So I think statistical analysis is a really powerful tool, and we can use it to take big piles of information about what our programs are doing and have the statistical model highlight things that may not be obvious at a glance, but turn out to be very important. This is what statistics are good at, taking big sets of data and distilling down the parts that are important. Another thing that is interesting about statistical models is that the more data you have, typically the more potent those models get in helping you draw conclusions. So I think that in a world where we have access to lots of data to collect about what our programs are doing, statistical models are especially useful because we have all that data. Another thing very much related to that is the idea of doing in situ data collection and analysis. So this is sort of like mechanisms like I think Tip's going to talk about later, where Google is instrumenting all the machines in their data centers and they're collecting lots and lots of analytics data in real time all the time. I think this is really neat. Because, like I said a second ago, we can use that data in statistical models, which is a cool way to analyze the behavior of a system. But it also captures realistic environmental constraints, and it captures those rare one in a million events. So if you have something that only happens, you know, when there's a lightning strike down the road and someone, you know, trips over one of the server racks, then you see that happen, and you can try and understand what you can do to fix that. So in situ data collection, I think, is a really interesting trend. Something that I've become especially interested in recently is what I like to think of as automation or mitigation rather than just analysis. So I think tools aren't something that we necessarily are going to use just during development time. And this is very much in the spirit of the in situ analysis I was just describing. Automation means that the system does analysis itself and then tries to fix things automatically. And I think that some people, this is something I hope would stir a conversation. Some people might not like the idea that tools are changing the behavior of systems automatically. So I hope to get opinions on that from this panel discussion. We're seeing this all over, though. Suggestions on fixes to make to code. Tools do this often, and the limit case of that is doing program synthesis, where the software tool actually replaces the programmer. There's no programmer, it's just you're generating code by pressing a button. Other examples are dynamic mitigation of failures, which is an area that I have been doing research in and I think is interesting, rather than just reporting problems to developers. So automation, not analysis, I think that's a really interesting trend. And the last trend I want to talk about is something that's near and dear to my heart. I'm in a way a computer architect, and I think that looking to bridge the gap between the tools research community and the hardware and computer architecture community is going to be a really important thing going forward, and I'm very interested in a lot of the interactions that could take place that could make hardware features that make it easier to develop tools and developing tools that make it easier for programmers to use novel hardware features. So there's really a two-way street, and I think that's going to be an important thing going forward. Mainly because it's difficult to decide often what goes in and what does not go into a piece of hardware. And I think making informed choices by conferring with both of these communities is going to be important. One more thing is that related to the automation and in situ use, hardware support facilitates those by making it possible to efficiently collect information that you can't collect any other way. So hardware support is a really powerful mechanism for doing those kinds of in deployment and fully automated techniques. So that's all I have to say, and I hope that we have a discussion after this, after everyone's had a chance to speak.
Very quickly do the change from Mac software to Office. Okay. Start with you, and then everybody You all know how to use a Mac. So just go to the left, go to the PowerPoint, and all of your things are loaded up by under your last name. Okay. Right. Oh, Jesus.
Okay.
Yay. That's awesome. We need some automatic mitigation,
yeah,
Brandon. Yeah, really. All right. Let's try this. Let's just do a recent. Try one more time. I have to say, I downloaded this from Google Drive in PowerPoint format, so I think, yeah. All right.
Some buck passing going on here. Yeah, Google Drive.
That's right. Let's see what happens here. I'm quitting PowerPoint. We're gonna start over. Okay. Great. Window. Oh my God.
Yeah, perhaps we can just do it in the slide view.
Yeah, that's what we're gonna do. Hopefully, well, I'll hide your notes if you have any, too. There we go. All right. Sad. Go for it.
Hey, everybody. I'm Tip Mosley from Google. I'm going to try to make this really quick because this is a panel. We should be talking and arguing and not listening to me dictate things. Instead of talking about tools directly, I'm going to talk about challenges because tools solve challenges. First, I'll talk a bit about what I work on at Google. I work on a project called Google-wide profiling. I think of it like Unix top for Google. So on top, you can see the top processes on your machine. Google-wide profiling gives people a view of the top things in the data center for a bunch of different metrics. How many cycles are being used, how many cache misses, heap growth, memory content, lock contention, that kind of thing. So we're collecting hundreds of thousands of profiles every day and aggregating those results so we can see, hey, Google does a lot of web search. So what works with development Google? Google's kind of an interesting place in that everything we have, we own the whole stack top to bottom, and everything is very well integrated. And so we have continuous testing infrastructures. Every time you submit a change, it automatically triggers tests for everything that depends on that change. And the build system has very tight integration both with the compiler tool chain as well as with debugging tools. So we have things like memory sanitizers, memory checkers, race detectors, leak detectors, all that's built in. And so we get it for almost free. There's a little bit of configuration sometimes, but I'm going to make a provocative statement and say that this is kind of a solved problem. Like, you know, more research into better race detectors and that kind of thing, they're kind of interesting in a sense, but these things work very well. And for test cases that trigger these things, we can find the problem using the tools we have. Load tests, I say they sometimes work. When the load test actually covers and models the behavior of your code, load tests are a great thing. Unfortunately, at Google, our systems are enormous and they span hundreds or thousands of machines. And so a single load test, it's very hard to encapsulate all of the things that you need to model into one single load test and have that run in isolation and be repeatable. One of the things that we do is try to measure things in production, and measuring things in production involves either sampling or tracing. And so Brandon talked a lot about tracing, so I'm going to not talk too much about it. What doesn't work? All kinds of things don't work. Scale is a huge problem. So having tens of thousands of machines and trying to figure out when something's going wrong, it's amazingly hard because there's a lot going on and it's hard to measure everything at once. So one in a million things, a race condition that, you know, might only occur one in a million requests, is something that happens all the time. It's consistently happening. And so things like memory leaks, buffer overruns, and even hardware failures, we see these things in the wild. And the applications that we deal with are orders of magnitude bigger than anything that you have to play with in academia. I think that some of the people that I work with complain about how we can't even link some of the applications in the build cluster sometimes because they're so large. And so we have to link on local machines because they're too big to link. And so that translates to problems in analysis too. You can't do static analysis on these code at some level. And you can't do really high overhead analysis on these things. Like I said before, the complexity of production behavior is extremely hard to model because there are so many external dependencies, not just on software systems, but based on time of day, time of year, and what else is running on the machine, which is contention. So these machines are now quite large. You've got tens, soon to be hundreds of cores on these machines, and they're completely shared. And so, you know, web search might be running on a machine with a MapReduce job, and they have completely different behaviors, and they're contending for memory bandwidth, they're contending for disk resources, and being able to manage those well, it's very difficult to plan for and predict. Additionally, the testing matrix is kind of a combinatoric explosion. So there are different versions of hardware, there are different versions of software, and there are different, every combination of those means that it's another case that we have to test before we deploy to production. The really hard part of parallel systems in Google is that they cross boundaries. And so if you've got a distributed application that, or every application is distributed in a sense, and every application spans multiple systems. So, you know, if you think about a request, it comes in from the client, which is a web browser, which is an amazingly complex thing. And it goes through a bunch of routers, which are equally complex, come into a front end, which distributes to back ends depending on what kind of request type it is. And then the back ends talk to some storage. And so your request might touch tens or hundreds of different machines on its way from your web browser to the back end. And at each hop, there are different models of parallelism. There are queues in user space, there are queues in kernel space. And so if there's a stall somewhere, it's very difficult to figure out where that stall was and then why it happened. And so you've probably heard a lot of people talk about long tail latency. Long tail latency is really hard to deal with. And so having tools to mitigate that problem is something we haven't solved. So what would help? I think that a lot of tools in academic research focus on being able to solve existing problems better, but the performance is really, really critical. So we have some tools that operate with very low overhead and are continually running in the data center, and those things are invaluable because the load tests and the testing infrastructures we have cover a lot of cases, but you can't possibly cover everything that happens in production. And so one in a million things happen all the time, and if we can continuously monitor these things in production, then we can have a reproducer case for something that we see. So things like error detection, doing race detection using hardware performance counters, or extremely low overhead sampling instrumentation and hardware support. That's what we want to see. So hopefully that was a little bit controversial.
Okay, so I'm going to try and make a very simple point in my few minutes, and that's essentially that even though we've all used lots of tools, we've all stared at TotalView, we've all stared at our favorite debuggers or profilers, the main tool that we all seem to fall back on when we hit the hard problems is essentially coffee, okay? Coffee and lots of hours and get the most experienced guy in the room, okay? And I'm going to try and give some examples of some problems that we found, we've solved, or maybe not solved fully, and just had to mitigate and just beg for tools, right? These are the kinds of things that we see going wrong in the real world. So I don't know if you can see this, but essentially there's this red line going across this chart, okay? And these are latency spikes happening every 500 milliseconds on a real world production application, right? All that happened was an OS upgrade. Everything you would expect to be done for a low latency application, and this was a real world low latency application that was putting money at risk in financial markets. After an OS upgrade, every 500 milliseconds, a latency spike, right? So think about all your favorite tools. How on earth would you have figured out what was causing this? Turned out to be a single OS setting on the kernel, okay? Transparent huge pages, sounds awesome, terrible idea, right? So think about that one. Here's a slightly worse one, okay? New version of the machine gets rolled in, okay? Run a highly tuned application, and what you see are, on the top one, latency spikes up in the 7 to 8 microsecond range. Okay? You break out your tools, what do? You work your way through all the usual stuff, you still haven't found it. Turns out you actually had to go hack the BIOS. Okay? How many people have had to go hack the BIOS, and how would their tools have led them to go hack on the BIOS to fix a latency problem? Okay, after tuning that and banging on various things you can set in the hardware before the BIOS locks you out, you get it down to 1.5 to 2.5 microsecond range. Okay, that's really not bad. And for this application, that was the difference between making a lot of money and losing a lot of money. Okay. So very motivated people, and essentially their best tool at the time was coffee. Okay. There was no tools got them that far. So those were single applications on dedicated machines. Now let's start getting a little more complicated. Let's throw a couple of single-threaded applications onto the same box. Okay. So previous speakers have talked about things like contention for shared resources. Well, here's a simple one. How many of your tools would have told you that you were getting DRAM row buffer conflicts from running multiple applications? Okay. Good tools for that? Not so much. Okay. Some people have built their own. There's things you can attach to the machines and figure this stuff out. Most software guys staring at a profiler really wouldn't understand what's going on at this point, I think it's fair to say. So essentially what I'm inching up to is the general curse of multi-tenancy. And every interesting system I look at these days is becoming multi-tenant whether we like it or not. Okay, so we have to raise the utilization on our machines, so we're all co-scheduling and we're trying to find non-interfering workloads and so on. That's a whole complicated mess all by itself that we can talk about. But then there's also interesting things where we're trying to harvest stuff. Okay, so it's really common, at least in enterprise applications, to short stroke your disk. So you're just going to use a part of the disk and not let the head move around too much. So you might use the outer tracks on the disk, for instance. And then someone has the really bright idea, we're going to harvest the inner tracks and use them for really cold storage where we don't expect to read these things very often. So we're going to reclaim the capacity and hardly ever touch them. Except then there's an application change. Someone does something and you're suddenly hitting your inner tracks. Now you're ping-ponging around and you get weird latencies. Okay, would your favorite tools have found that for you, figured that one out for you? Exactly the same with networks. Okay, we've got very different application types trying to share this network. So a lot of us have these kind of fan out, fan back in, latency sensitive applications. Okay, so there's a whole class of problems there about what happens when you have that in cast. Okay? But then let's throw something else in there. We want to soak up excess capacity on this cluster. So what we're going to do is have big background low priority jobs doing strange things. They're like gigantic whales swimming by on your cluster, and it can have bizarre, bizarre effects if you don't do this properly. Then there's also things like we're trying to schedule for thermal equilibrium in the data center. Okay, we're trying to keep constant temperature across it, right? So you want to do certain things there, but that's completely at odds with some of the other things we're trying to do, like think about data locality. Right, think about scheduling for this. That actually runs contrary in a lot of cases to scheduling for thermal equilibrium. And this is just when the applications are allegedly in a fairly steady state. Okay, you'd be amazed at some of the things that happen as you try and boot this stuff up, provision new applications, hit recoveries. I'm not sure what's actually worse, you know, a failure or the resulting recovery. It could have massive impact on your cluster. So a lot of us have built over the years a lot of ad hoc tools to try to deal with this. And some of these are escaping into public knowledge at this point, but I haven't seen any consistent research on, here, let me take this really nasty environment and solve the hardest problem, which is figuring out deep in the system where things are going wrong. Okay. Now, just to give it a little bit more sense of it, we often tell people just to worry about parallelism and locality and so on. But at what levels are we really asking them to think about this? And particularly in a multi-tenancy world, there are often very conflicting demands about whether you want to just optimize for the whole machine or optimize for the fact that you're living in this world and sharing it with lots of other people, right? So just think of things like dueling schedulers, right? Lots of different parallel applications conflicting on the machine. And then there's also the fact that we're giving people layers of abstraction and very nasty problems, okay? So I've spent a lot of time trying to explain to people, here's what your hardware actually does. Right? If you want your software to make use of it, here's what you need to do. They don't like those answers. I also don't like the requests that come in that say, there's some weird problem, can't your software just fix that? Okay, that happens all the time. There's someone who's dealt with it. And to be honest, even figuring out what to whine about is kind of hard. Okay, we can have problems where it takes 2,000 hours to say, yep, the kernel crashed, weird memory corruption, someone screwed up somewhere, good luck with that. Right? These things really happen. Quick example. I had a nasty cluster environment where people kept swapping hardware in and out, and I wanted to use direct cache access. This was a few years ago, predecessor to DDIO. We ended up doing something nasty like this, which is, let's ignore what the BIOS is saying because someone has set something wrong, or it's lying to us, or we're locked out of it. Let's ignore what the operating system is saying. Figure out from the manuals, here's how to go bang on a register and make sure we have it. Okay? It's a very nasty world out there, and hardware lies to you and software lies to you. So I think I'll leave it there, and hopefully we can start arguing about some of this in remarks afterwards. Thank you.
Let's see if this works any better. Nope, it's not going to work any better.
That's a hilarious error.
Let's see, is there a, which is the right button to go better than that? This one?
How about that?
Yeah. That's a little better, I guess. Okay. All right, so one thing I wanted to start with was basically this notice here. When you're in the software tools business, sometimes the government gets involved, and we have to admit that our software tools run better on our hardware than other people's hardware. That's kind of obvious, but that's something you get into when you're in the software tools business of trying to be honest about what you're trying to accomplish. So I'm here talking about Intel. I'm representing myself. I'm not an official Intel spokesman, but I can tell you a little bit about some of my experiences and what that might mean. So if you look at this picture, this might be the Intel you're familiar with. Most of you in the room probably are running an Intel processor on one or more of your devices. Intel's pretty good at building silicon, so why would a hardware company be invited to talk at a kind of more software-oriented tools panel? Part of this is HotPAR is all about parallelism, and we've been through the transition to move from your normal sequential high-performance machines into parallel machines. It's done. We made that transition years ago, and pretty much everything that shipped in volume is a multi-core chip today. But if you look at the range of chips, you've got everything from, say, on the left-hand side, an example of the chip that's now in the number one high-performance machine in the world, the one that was recently announced in China, all the way to the right, which is probably the processor that's going to be on your cell phone next year, or if you're lucky, this year. In the middle, you've got the things running in the notebooks that you use for your daily work. But what software got to do with this? These are all hardware chips. Well, in the bottom part of this graph, there's all sorts of features on your platform that unless you write very specific software for, you can't use any of those features. Who's going to help you use those features, use the parallelism, use some of the accelerators, get access to some of the performance monitoring capabilities so that you can understand how to tune your application? Well, that's where there's the other side of Intel. This is the software side of the company. Let's see. And if you look at Intel only as a software company, ignore all the fact that it's got fabs and produces hardware, it's in the top 10 companies in the world in terms of software engineers, software revenue, software products. You may not have quite known that, but there's an extremely wide range of software that Intel worries about. It worries about the BIOS that boots your machine. We write that. It worries about the device drivers that are accessing all the different hardware facilities on the machine. It worries about the profilers and the compilers and the software stack people use to write the applications that go onto the machine. We work with operating systems to our companies to optimize their performance. We've got well over 14,000 engineers worldwide, and it is a worldwide activity. This isn't concentrated in any one place. So let's talk a little bit about introducing the things I'm responsible for, which will set the tone for maybe some of the questions you might want to ask, because I can answer those questions a little bit better. I work on the Parallel Studio suite of products. I've been the architect for a couple of the different components, and I was recently the architect for the entire thing, trying to organize how are we going to add features to the suite, what features should be, how are we going to drive the software development team so that they can actually deliver it on schedule. That's a harder problem than you might think. How are we going to keep the cadence where the software tools match the hardware roadmap? Those types of things. So we focus on the node level and also at the cluster level with some of the tools. Threading is obviously at the node level. We produce highly optimized MPI stacks for the cluster marketplace, and tracing and analysis tools both for the node level and the cluster level. Here's an example of some of the software our group produces. I can talk a little bit as questions come up about how we get through delivering some of this software. One of the interesting ones that I find out people don't really know a lot about is the one at the top. It's the tool called Advisor as part of the suite. There's been a really hard problem for a very long time that most of the software in the world's sequential. It's not parallel. How do you convince people to change it from sequential to parallel? Well, the best answer up until we got this tool on the market was you write automatic parallelizing compilers and hope that your compiler is smart enough to do it. Most of the time it isn't, but it does a pretty good job. Taking a look at that tool goes through more of an interactive profile-based methodology to help people walk through the steps of creating parallel programs. The composer parts, the libraries, if you're doing parallel programming, you might be doing it in OpenMP, SIL, threading building blocks. We write the runtimes and the compilers for doing all that. VTune is one of the tools every other profiling tool compares itself against for performance profiling. It's existed for a couple decades, and we continually reinvent it to try to take advantage of the new features on the hardware. I was the architect for the Intel Inspector for the Memory Checker and Thread Checker for a few years. That project's been going on for at least 10 to 15 years. And then the Trace Analyzer and Collector is the MPI tools. So this gives you kind of a very informal overview that Intel's not just a hardware company. It's one of the biggest software companies in the world. And mostly it deals with the software you don't see. It deals with the lower level software. It deals with the enabling software where the people who write the applications might use to create their value add in the industry. So thank you.
See if this is on. Yes, good. Okay, if people would just come up to the mic with questions to talk to the panelists. And get things going. So let's see. I love the best tool is coffee comment, by the way. That was pretty funny. That's my favorite tool. So let's see. Let me pick one. So actually, I have a question for Tip. So scale obviously is a problem for Google. But I wonder if some of the concerns that you have are a more of a Google-only problem. Right, so there's a long tail of people working in all sorts of other environments, and then there's Google and Facebook and Microsoft, let's say, who have these giant data centers and have these huge workloads. Are some of your comments really sort of Google specific, do you think? Or do you think that the lessons are more broadly applicable?
I think today they're fairly Google specific, but in 10 years these are problems, we're sort of the leading edge, and they're problems that everybody's going to have to deal with, because even in portable and mobile devices, you're going to have a lot more cores. And the problems that affect distributed applications, these design patterns, I think are going to make their way onto smaller devices. And so solving this is sort of a research problem that needs to be more invested in right now.
I have a comment to add to that, actually. So I don't know about the inside of Google or anything like that, but what I was thinking as Tip was answering that question is that everyone's not just going to be writing code for small devices that has the same problems, but rather cloud computing is like a commodity now, so you can go and push a million copies of your software out, and they're going to be interacting in maybe some of the same ways as the stuff inside of Google or Microsoft or wherever. So I kind of agree that like in the future, it's very likely that these are going to be everyone's problems, not just the problems of like the big four companies or what have you. So,
well, I'd add a little bit to that. These are everyone's problems. I didn't list my top three list of things customers complain about. I figured I'd let people ask that. But number one is tools, especially debugging tools, shouldn't break. The thing that pisses people off the most is when their debugger crashes. That really annoys people. So software quality of software tools is usually the biggest complaint we have, that tools should just work. And if they don't, people get very upset. They say, well, I'm writing software, my software can crash, your software can't crash. So quality is an important thing. The next thing is for anything other than hardware tools, speed matters. As I said, I was involved in the thread checker development for a while. That's one of the slowest tools in existence. Everyone complains about speed of that tool. When you get down in the 10% overhead range, people are getting happy, and then they basically talk about Heisen bugs or things where basically the tool's changing the behavior of the system under test, and therefore you're not measuring what you think you're measuring. And then once the tool's fast enough, they say it doesn't give me enough data. And so there's always this tension between I want it faster, I want it richer. I want it faster, I want it richer. So we're there now. It's not just at the extreme scale Google's at. Everyone on their desktop's the same way.
And there's actually a lot of people out there have not Google-sized clusters, but smaller clusters where a lot of these problems still exist, right? Just ask the guy who used to work on one machine what it's like trying to get stack traces across 1,000 machines. There's a lot of people aren't prepared for that type of transition. That's actually a hard problem, right? For people who have this infrastructure, let alone people who are out there running just straight off the cliff into nasty cluster programming problems.
Starting back at the other end of the table again, you mentioned that you consider race detection a solved problem, race detection tools a solved problem, and I'm interested in how did you solve that problem? What tools do you actually use for that?
I didn't solve it myself. People much smarter than I solved those problems. We have tools built on Valgrind and things built into the compiler that just do, I don't know what algorithms they use, but they seem to just work with reasonable overhead. And so it seems like a lot of the research is based on either fine-tuning edge cases in the states that you can be in as far as finding races that don't occur very often or could potentially occur. And we sort of solve the problem a different way, or at least in practice we do it a different way, which is we just have very good test coverage and have tools that operate with reasonable overhead. And I think that the algorithms that have been proposed over 10 years ago work well enough. And so I was being a little provocative when I said solved, but they work well enough. And we have problems at the other end of the spectrum that we don't have tools that work well enough. That is to be able to do race detection on production code, because that's when the races happen that the tools don't find and can't find.
So I was hoping someone would bring this up because I really wanted to disagree with you on this one. I think that data race detection is not solved in a way that's related to what you were just saying. So when people have 10% overhead, then they begin to be satisfied. But race detection is not 10%; it's 10x overhead,
right.
And that might be acceptable because races are really hard bugs to find. And so you guys seem satisfied at that. But I think that an interesting direction of research to link this back to some of the stuff that I talked about in my presentation is trying to do race detection and deployment with production overheads, meaning
okay. You
can tolerate fractional percent, things okay. Like that. So I think that direction of race detection.
That side certainly is not solved. Yeah. That's the side I want solved.
Yeah, so I think that's a really cool area to work in. I think hardware support is a great match for that problem, too, like very carefully designed pieces of hardware that are intended to support that. So.
This is for, is it Tim?
Yes.
Google? So one of the things that you said that hit home to me was how poor the current models of behavior are. And so there's not a lot you can do in academia because there are very complex things, long tail events happening all the time, one in a million happening all the time. And so my question is, within Google, what is the attitude about putting out things like measurements and statistics and models that the academic world can use to actually address these problems? I think somebody else made the comment that a lot of the problems that academics work on are really boring, in part, and I think that's just because there's not a lot else you can do with the information that's out there. Uh-huh. And so I'm just curious what you guys think about that, if there's ever any chance of measurement papers coming out on your data center, things like that.
So we actually do publish a decent number of measurement papers. I've published a couple, and the cluster management team publishes papers all the time. For example, Jason Mars and Ling Jia Tang interned with us for like 4 or 5 summers, and there's just a constant stream of papers coming out of those guys about our workloads. It's kind of tough to be in academia and work on this problem, and I try to yell about it as often as I can. We have some efforts to get better at open sourcing some of the traces and workloads and methodologies. What I recommend is, you know, if you've got students, send them as interns, because they come away with so much experience and knowledge from that. Sometimes professors come and do professor internships, and it really gives a lot of insight into how the world works inside the data center, because it's something that, you know, even if you hear me talk about it, it's not the same. I've been there for 3.5 years, and I'm still sort of at awe sometimes at the scale of things and the unexpected things that will happen. So that said, I think that instead of trying to simulate the large systems we have, focus on smaller problems that you read papers about that occur in those large systems. I see a lot of papers that are like, we ran spec 1,000 times on this machine, and that's our data center paper, and that has absolutely no application.
So I think it's also interesting that very few people seem to be working on trying to figure out what the hell is happening when you have incomplete information, right? So it's one thing to sit inside a company and to be able to look all the way down to the bare metal. There's a lot of people out there don't have that luxury, either because they're running on top of a closed source file system or they're running in something like a public cloud. And these guys have immense problems figuring out why they're getting latencies swinging around all over the place, why they're getting bandwidth swinging around all over the place. So trying to build tools that actually help in the face of all this incomplete information might be an interesting approach.
Hi. So I just wanted to touch on what the previous question brought up is, how do you export all this stuff? You guys are from very well-funded organizations that have these problems at a huge scale. People in general are going to experience these things in 10 years, you said. How do you get this? How do you get these problems exported to researchers all over the place so you can exploit like the manpower that we all have, right? Going to an internship is one thing, but maybe improving benchmarks. Or I just wanted to hear you guys' thoughts on that.
Well, one of the things that Intel does is basically fund research groups. Intel Labs funds some of them. Kim might be an example of a beneficiary. She worked with our group working on binary instrumentation for quite a few years before moving on. We're usually looking for proposals of things that might be a little out there, things which can change the world, especially if there's a hardware hook to it. Then we can get the hardware teams excited about it. Now, if you've got a hardware idea, you've basically chosen the highest bar in the world in order to cross in terms of convincing people to do it. But it also has the highest payoff, because that's the only way we're going to get to the 3%, 5% overhead level, is basically to have it running constantly as the machine runs without hardly any software overhead whatsoever.
And I can comment from the academic perspective, actually. Something that we found useful is using the public cloud. And maybe that's a poor estimate, but it gives us an estimate. I mean, we're not at Google scale, but we're at larger than spec 1,000 times on one machine. So I think that that's a useful tool for approximating what these scale-out problems are. It's not a complete solution, and the results are maybe not even comparable to something you'd get inside a Google data center, though, so that's important to keep in mind.
It's trending up, though. I'm reading more papers that are using things like Hadoop in their measurements, and it's still something of a toy, relatively, but it's getting much, much better as far as being convincing and having useful results and observations.
You can also build a surprisingly powerful system for not a lot of money these days, right? So if you're using microservers, for instance, you could put 1,000 microservers in a rack if you put your mind to it, and then that's actually an interesting size cluster. And it doesn't really matter that they're slower than a high-end Sandy Bridge or whatever in terms of recreating these types of problems you're going to see. And it's also not that hard to come up with ways to fake workloads using, you know, things that look just statistically try to inject the right kind of noise in the systems and so on. So I think you can actually fake up in even a half rack worth of stuff, something that gives you a lot of nasty problems, and then try and figure out how to fix those.
It's interesting. This was a problem in the computer architecture community. People were trying to figure out how they could simulate large design, running real workloads on large designs, and the overheads of doing that are so much that you would spend years running simulations to get precise answers. And so people have lots of techniques for dealing this. One of them is to find a representative portion of the workload and then to derive general results from that representative portion. And a lot of work has gone into figuring out what is representative. So we might have a similar problem on our hands, actually. That might be something that we should all be thinking about going forward, is ways that we can do this without having to have 1,000 microservers, but rather some representative, smaller, more affordable, and more accessible system. And I don't know if there's a way to do that, but it'd be interesting if there was. So
yeah, you said you can build the hardware cheaply, and I agree with that. What would you suggest they run? What software is good at exacerbating these kinds of problems that's available?
I don't think there's anything good off the shelf to grab, fortunately, right? So I think the trick is just to understand the different types of workloads and then just fake
them
and then mix them. I think that's the interesting part, right? Yeah. So just, slap Linux on there, because realistically that's what everyone's doing, right? We all have our own kernels with various patches and whatever, but you can get started with just off the shelf. Then if you really want to run spec in, sure, throw it in there as a kind of a batch workload, but then throw in some latency sensitive stuff, throw in some noise generators, throw in something that tries to just hog bandwidth. Okay, just abuse the machine, right? Because that's pretty much what your users are going to do. Okay, so I mentioned I work a lot on broken machines. That's because you kind of design things and it's all nice and lovely, and then it hits the real world, and then that's when all the nasty phone calls and your caffeine consumption goes through the roof, right? So just abuse the machines in horrible, horrible ways, and it looks like a user, right?
I have a question on something completely different. It's actually what Brandon was talking about automatically fixing bugs, right? So I spent about a year and a half doing this last part of my thesis. I actually wrote a system that detects data races and then automatically comes up with a way of solving them. Presented this in SOSP a couple of years ago. And the problem with the system that I realized, right after we built it and we started testing it, we spent about 8 months testing it all sorts of different programs, was that oftentimes, it was actually pretty good. It was looking at things from the operating system level. But what it would find was, I really wanted to find, let's say, bugs in MySQL or Apache. It would find all sorts of random things that are happening in glibc, or like in the library or in the software stack that's kind of beneath the application that you're testing. Because it turns out that, glibc and so on will use a compare and swap, or use certain non-locking implementations to actually protect data or protect certain shared axes and so on. And similarly, even people who built MySQL libraries or additional modules would actually write their own versions of lock-free implementations that they think would be right, blah, blah, blah. So what that meant was, I actually just wanted to find certain bugs in MySQL, but then I got debugging all these random things across the stack, and that just was really weird and problematic. So the question here is, if you actually imagine a world where you would have these automatic detection and fixes, how do you actually think we should think across the stack, right? And I'm just talking something very simple for my test case, but in the real world, when there's thousands of dependencies, all these link problems that TIP's running into, which we run into at Facebook as well, it really makes me think that this whole notion of automatic detection and fixing and remediation is at least 10, 15 years out. I have no hope for solving this in the next decade. What would you say to that?
Yeah, so I think that there are a few things in that question. So the first one related to the fact that you have custom synchronization primitives and programmers have different ways of doing things. I think that's a matter of communication, and there's a real role for tools researchers to do something there. If programmers don't have a way of communicating that information down to a system like the one that you described that you built, then... Sure, but you mentioned in glibc, if you use a compare and swap, then that doesn't show up in your tool. And I think that that's a matter of having a mechanism to help programmers communicate that information down. Now, related to the other problem where you have the coordination of many pieces of code, I think that software engineering researchers have been looking at that for a long time, and there's problems, there's a tension between abstraction and flexibility, because you want to be able to change all the things you want to change, but you want clean abstraction boundaries, so that's tough. I've got a kind of anecdotal piece of research that a friend of mine is working on, and he's looking at races that are introduced by the garbage collector. So if you have some garbage collected code and it moves memory around, giving it a new address different from the one that it was at before, you may now have a race that's a spurious race. And very few, if any, data race detection papers that I've seen account for the fact that data can be moved. So that's a tricky problem. It's current research. I wouldn't speculate, you know, 10, 15 years, I don't know, maybe it is that far off, but I do have faith that there are techniques that can make these systems more robust. Maybe they won't be perfect, but I think they can improve the reliability of these systems by baking some of these analyses in and pushing them into production.
So. I guess the abstract part, but I don't know, do you think that people actually rewrite model libraries and so on to use some of these better abstractions, or maybe, you know, let's say we call it a new way of communication process stuff? Do you think people actually go to the point of rewriting our libraries for underlying systems code, or do you think that we would, you know, we kind of need this thing which automatically goes through and changes software in place or dynamically changes something completely? What do you think about this?
I think it's very unlikely that everyone's going to go and rewrite all their libraries for any of this. I do have faith that we can get enough information to make useful changes. Like I said, maybe they won't be complete changes, but I think that we can get enough information to make useful changes. And that's progress. And once we have enough useful changes, maybe then they will appear to be complete changes.
So. I actually think that they will rewrite the libraries. We have to look at all the process.
Okay.
And then, okay. For this, if you look at a lot of the web development things, right?
Yeah.
People are writing awesome JavaScript libraries. There's all these new functional libraries which are kind of coming back again because, hey, they just improved developer productivity so much. So we spent a lot of our time kind of just like, something is cracked. Let's actually rewrite a new library that, you know, I mean, it's not like you replace it 100%. You kind of say, let's replace the most common things. And you say, oh, now let me replace the performant ones. Now let me replace, you know, taking out the fast ones, make debugging easier. So I actually do think that some of the, I mean, GLibC might be too big, right, a beast attack. But I actually do think that rewriting software is better abstractions. It is far easier because there's course of new programmers who are actually like graduating school and coming out and they want to do interesting things and they realize what's impeding their progress, and a lot of these people are very motivated. I work with a bunch of them. It's awesome. They're actually willing to write new libraries.
But there's only so much rewriting that you can do. I think that it's not reasonable to expect that. I mean, so maybe this works at Facebook where you have lots of developers and you can actually, you know, take on the burden of rewriting all these libraries.
Right? I mean, let's say it works slightly better.
Sure, well, it would work slightly better in your situation, but maybe you have some, you know, customization in the library that you knew would benefit you in particular, and now it goes into a different deployment, and, you know, it's not reasonable to expect that each different development house, especially with the thousands and thousands of startups that are doing this kind of thing, they're not each going to rewrite their libraries in the same, you know, customized way. So I think that, you know, to be a little less black and white about it, I think there'll probably be some of each of those things. There'll be some of these techniques like I described that, you know, you expect are 10 to 15 years out where the software adapts to the environment, and some of it will be people rewriting libraries. But I don't think it's going to be a black and white solution. I don't think it's going to be either or.
I don't believe you.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
I'll take the stance that it actually has to happen at the language level, that software at the level of libc, it's just impossible to gather the information that you want from the programmer. And so more restrictive memory models or more well-defined memory models are the road to having sanity at the developer level. Maybe not as much performance, but much more developer productivity and maybe better scalability.
The problem, I think, for people who are developing software is finding the bugs, not fixing them, because if you find a Heisen bug, you can mostly fix it, or most people can. I think one of the problems with anomaly detection, for instance, is when you start developing a big multi-threaded, multi-processing distributed thing, your whole program's an anomaly. Everything's an outlier, so it's hard to compare with something good. I think that's anomaly detection is fine for programs that are already running. For new programs, you need to convert those Heisen bugs to Bohr bugs. And one of the things that we learned at Tandem a long time ago, back in the old days, was to do that, most of the really terrible problems are in the queuing parts of code. In other words, when things get blocked and things start to queue up and then you have a failure, and you have code that doesn't get tested very much, and that stuff is found out in the field, and that's a problem. And so what you have to do is insert random stutters, delays, to open the windows, and then start popping code in random places. And tools that do that, I don't see any tools that do that. Maybe Google has tools like that. But that's the way you, I think, find these bugs in the lab as opposed to out in the field.
So someone at Microsoft Research named Peter Boddick has a paper at, I forget which conference, but he's addressing this exact problem of inter-domain queues and the kind of congestion that you get there and how you can, this paper was to characterize and understand the problem, and I think they're working now on ways of dealing with that problem. So people are in fact looking at that. Some people are looking at that.
I mean, otherwise you're going to be at 10, and we used to run tests forever, and you couldn't find these bugs. So you had to find a way to coax them out.
I think there's a lot of people building currently ad hoc tools for inserting various types of chaos or loads on public clouds and so on, and you tend to trip over a lot of these things. And I think one of the main lessons for programmers there is not just go build those tools, but also it teaches people to design for debuggability and design for all these things, where instead of focusing on your nice expected path through the program, actually all these other paths really do matter, right, and can absolutely kill you in production. Right? So I think creating adversarial environments is pretty common these days in various places, even though there hasn't been a lot of work on how do you do that efficiently, right? How do you actually maximize stress on the application or maximize exploration of the space in a sense?
I just had a comment on what you just said about the whole application being an anomaly. I think that if the whole application is an anomaly, then you should change the statistics you're using because that probably isn't working very well, or you should collect more data. And collecting more data could mean increase the number of users, and that will happen over time, or it could mean increase the amount of time. But it just won't be the case that things will stay anomalies forever because there is some quiescent behavior of the system. Your system is intended to do something and it does it. And if you watch long enough, you'll see that that's the standard thing that it's doing and you will be able to differentiate. It's a data problem. Yeah, it'll start off as an anomaly, but it's absolutely a data problem. If you scale in either the time that you watch or the number of instances that you're watching, then you can solve this problem by having more data.
It might be a data problem that a human can't scale to understand, though. I mean,
So this is the role of statistical methods, though. I mean, you have statistical methods that are designed to highlight non-obvious but important features and make them salient features in that data. And there's been some work recently that tries to do that to help understand concurrency bugs and why they happen. And I think that there's probably a role for that in performance analysis, too, in surfacing those non-obvious features from large data sets.
Yeah. One other point people were asking about how you can get involved, Intel produces software tool products. We also release software tools infrastructure. If you're not using a tool called PIN, you should be. It's basically the basis for the research of a lot of tools, and it's got a couple modes. One is a JIT mode, that's expensive. It's got a probe mode, which is really cheap, and that's really good for introducing perturbation into a system or for observing the system at a high level and very low cost. So there is infrastructure for building those things. Yeah, you've got to be smart about it. Yeah.
So let me ask them a pretty broad question, I think. So in addition to the gigantic search space we have for figuring out what's wrong, because, you know, just to complete the software systems, we have two other things which are hugely complicated. So you guys have dealt with it a little bit. One is performance cliffs, where at the bottom, in order to make something really efficient, you have to do crazy stuff that the users don't really want to deal with in order to kind of go home to hang out with their kids and actually get their job done. But that's really important cliff to have in order to get good performance. The other one is abstraction cliffs, where you have many different possible implementations of something, and you have to kind of forget this. I mean, in order to work with an arbitrary company X and have, you know, 10 different people implement that, you need to kind of wall yourself off away from them. In order to have a viable software and hardware industry, we need those, but in order to track down bugs, they kill us. So how do you guys, you know, propose to deal with these, you know, overcoming these very important cliffs, you know, that are important for software design?
I can start with that. We tend to think of the system from the transistors on up. So most of our tools tend to work at the assembly language level underneath all the software. So when we're measuring performance, when we're measuring correctness, it's almost always at the assembly language level, which means then we have an abstraction problem of how do we relate what the hardware is doing back to the right. user. And that's where we need extremely good debug information coming from the compilers, especially optimized compilers. That's still an unsolved problem. Maybe Convex solved it 20 years ago, but we forgot how to do it. Once you turn on the optimizer, it turns off the symbolic stuff in most cases, or at least makes it misleading, if not wrong. But it's building instrumentation at multiple levels in the software stack. So you have the stuff at the very low level, but then you have markers at the higher level about what is the abstraction doing, and then what is the hardware doing relative to that abstraction, and then presenting it all the way back up to the user source code that they wrote, not the system software. So it's unwinding that, and that's sort of a symbolic analysis problem once you have the data. But the important thing we feel is to collect the data at the place where it happens, which is as close to the hardware as possible. And then the rest of it is just providing the context for how to understand that.
Go ahead.
I have an interesting data point with respect to the comment on debug information. I think that if the incentives are in the right place, that can be improved. So, for example, at Google, we're working on using samples that we collect from hardware to do continuous feedback-directed optimization in the compiler. And to be able to do that, you have to be able to map assembly code back to source code. And so when we started on this project, the mappings were just terrible. But because there's 15% more performance to be had, there's a strong incentive to get the debug information right.
And one thing to add to what you were saying a second ago about passing information up from down in the hardware through the layers to something that's useful for a tool, I love the idea of doing that, and I would love to, in the future, see more different kinds of information get passed up because people are concerned about different things now. So in the world of concurrency, maybe having explicit information about coherence traffic and things like that might be useful to some tool. I don't know if that's out there, but I mean, you might be able to use that kind of information to understand congestion. You said row conflicts in the memory, like that isn't currently exposed, or if it is, it's sort of an arcane way of getting at it. People are concerned about energy. It might be interesting to see what can you say about energy up the stack using new hardware mechanisms. And I mean, I'm just making suggestions here that I think might be useful. I'm sure people with real applications would have lots of other suggestions too.
Well, I'm not actually very much interested in building tools for kind of everyday programmers who just want to write a little piece of code and go home. Okay? I really don't care at that point. So I have friends who care about extreme performance, right? They get paid for being faster. So I care about tools for those guys. Then I care about people who have to run all the other crap that people are writing. Okay? Because they're the people that are sufficiently motivated to go figure out, okay, in this million lines of stuff, what's wrong and how do I fix it, right? And they're the guys who have to look at things right the way across the stack. And it's not some guy who wrote some script up the top who's going to sit there and figure out, I'm doing this really nasty thing to the system, maybe I shouldn't do that, right? He's the guy who just wants to write a script and go home. Maybe he doesn't have the skills, maybe he just needs to get on with his job, okay? So I don't think we need to necessarily solve the problem for those guys. We need to solve the problem for the people who are motivated to go in and figure it out. And the tools, even for those guys, I think are sorely lacking. So I'd rather solve that problem first.
All right, so we're going to have to wrap it up. Let's thank our panel again.